Our next speaker, I am actually very pleased to introduce, is Laura Nader, who is an anthropologist and professor at UC Berkeley, who deals with central dogmas about how systems work with law, energy science, and anthropology. Her most recent book, and all of her works, by the way, deal with all cross-disciplinary, basically she's crossing all disciplinary boundaries. But particularly her last book, co-authored with Ugo Mattei, who I understand is currently in Milan, and also teaches when he is not in Italy, is teaching at UC Hastings, is Plunder, When the Rule of Law is Illegal, the story about the dark side of the rule of law and how it has been used as a political weapon to legitimize plunder. Now, for those of us who have been in the practice of law for 30 years or so, we understand what our next speaker is going to be talking about. And for those of you who are students, Rihanna, who are about to enter into the world that I have now seen, pay rapt attention. And for those of you who are here for ethics credit, lawyers, I admonish you to all go sit in the corner while we listen to Laura Nader.
Thank you very much. I hope I'm not losing my voice, but I'll do my best. I'm humbled to be here. I'm awed by the previous speakers, and I think I owe you an introduction to why I think the way I do, because otherwise you might not understand what I'm going to do today. Judge Cardozo once said, no matter how objective we may try to be, we must never forget the fact that we see with our own eyes. And all of us do that, no matter what culture we come from. After all, Navajo means people, meaning that the rest of the world aren't. So I want to tell you a little bit about my point of view and why this will not be a lineal talk. I came into looking at law in the West from a non-Western position. When I was a graduate student at Harvard, I went to southern Mexico, to the Oaxaca Mountains, and I studied Zapotec Indian law. This was a town that had town meetings, just like my town in Connecticut. It had a court. It spoke of its relations with the state and federal government as one of exterior relations, relaciones exteriores, because they were autonomous. And they were meant to be autonomous by the Spanish crown as a means of protecting the Indians from the mestizos. I made a film about this called To Make the Balance. That was the first film. I made a second film that was called Little Injustices. That was PBS. And that was sold to over 75 countries, interestingly enough. It was supposed to be a transition film on the Odyssey series, 1980, and when President Reagan was elected, he cut off funding for the rest of the Odyssey films, which were supposed to be about anthropologists looking at American culture. I've had, apart from the Zapotec experience, under a large grant, generous grant from the Carnegie Corporation, we did a study in the 70s and 80s on how Americans complain. And the result of that was published in a book called No Access to Law. I then followed that with a book called The Life of the Law, which brought together all of the materials that 15 of my students had collected studying law in other societies, along with the work that we had done on American law. And in the book, Life of the Law, it was the light side of the law. It was the good side of the law. It was about what happens when the subaltern plaintiff gets empowered. And of course, there were cases discussed in there, like the Woburn leukemia cases, which was described in the book Civil Action, the Buffalo Creek disaster, which was about the worst coal disaster we probably had in the United States, except maybe more recently, The subaltern plaintiff was empowered, and we saw the light side of the law and what we could do. And the reason I wrote that book the way I did is because Justice Berger had in fact succeeded beyond his wildest dreams of convincing people that this was a litigious country, which in fact it is no more litigious than any Western industrial society, and starting a tort reform movement that was to decrease litigation and the wonderful part of the American legal system beyond belief in a very short time by introducing alternative dispute resolution, which started here and then was sent worldwide, interestingly, and that's part of our story in the book Plunder. Now, what got me into this whole notion of the plunder are certain people that have influenced my thinking about American law, apart from my own experience cross-culturally. There was Jerome Frank's book, Courts on Trial. I don't know how many of you have read that, but he has an interesting quote. He said, "In our trial courts today, is and ought remain too far apart. To separate ethics from the judicial process is to pervert the latter. We must ethicize the works of the courts." Very interesting thinker. Had nothing to do with what I was doing in anthropology at the time, but it came to have a lot to do. I was also influenced by Edmund Kahn, his book, The Sense of Injustice, which everybody should read and reread today, especially when there's so little compassion in the practices of law, especially in our largest law firms. He said, "Justice has been so beclouded as a concept by natural law writings that it is almost inevitable. It is almost inevitably brings to mind some ideal relation or static condition or set of perceptual standards. But the response to a real or imagined instance of injustice is something quite different. It is alive with movement and warmth in the human organism." Recently, I was invited to a conference at Yale on justice in the mirror, and it struck me that nobody at that conference, and there were many anthropologists, spoke about injustice. They were so busy speaking about the abstract justice. So Edmund Kahn, I decided we should not only reread him, we should rethink him in the context of what's happening today. And of course, the Lawyers Guild is an example of a group that does understand something about the importance of the sense of injustice. And then there's Ralph Nader, who looks at the law school curriculums. And he says, "Every profession has its own myths, totems, and taboos. In the legal system, these serve to camouflage the dependency of the legal status quo on the established power systems. Despite the reality of the legal system, the myth of equal justice moves on. The very spectrum of lawyer roles was narrowed by law schools in the design of their curriculum to meet the needs of Wall Street and LaSalle streets. Lawyers are the first to know, but mostly they remain silent." Some years ago, I was asked by Yale Law Journal to review a book on ethics and the practice of law. I was rather surprised to be asked. It was a book by Jeffrey Hazard. He was at Yale, I believe, at the same time. And it was the first of several symposiums on the ethics of the practicing professions. Elite lawyers and government lawyers, who constitute 10% of the profession, were there. The book, one page of narrow discussion to another. And the last page in the book, the last word in the book, money, summed up the reasons for my disappointment. The book did have a therapeutic function. The members of the bar were told they need worry not about the wide-ranging impact of their activities, but only about how to deal with their clients. A concern that dominates every page of the book, whether about fees, the adversary system, advice, conflict of interest, the book reflects the specialized professionals, practitioners' passion for technical skill, a value that seems to override what most people in this country think the purpose of the law should be, a more just society. The belief that legal ethics primarily involves the dyadic relations between lawyer and client. Let me say something about the dyadic. Deborah Rose, who's a professor at Stanford, leading expert on legal ethics, wrote a book some time ago called Equal Justice Under Law. There was an interesting quote about the legal profession. There is no other profession quite so smug and self-satisfied and at the same time quite so lacking in social obligation. Social obligation. An occasional rare soul, a Clarence Darrow, may dedicate his energies to the defense of unpopular causes and earn the supercilious disapproval of his more orthodox brethren. But these are, to use that most devastating epithet, the radicals. She goes on to point out that studies from the 60s found that the most generous firms averaged only about 5 hours of pro bono a week per attorney, less than 1% of the firm's billable time. In the 80s, surveyed lawyers averaged between 5 to 15 hours per year. Only about 5% of their work went to legal aid and indigent criminal defense. So legal ethics and the social obligations, when did that launch me into something else? I think it was not 9/11. Although that was predicted by people like Chalmers Johnson. In fact, it was predicted by a CIA agent in 1964. People that go around the world doing nasty things to other people can expect to have something like that happen, right? But it wasn't that. Interestingly enough, it was Bush, President Bush, sending Paul Bremer III to Iraq to run the coalition provisional government. We went to Iraq, presumably, because they had weapons of mass destruction. We then found out they didn't have weapons of mass destruction. So we had to have another reason to be there. We couldn't say up front it was about oil, although people made jokes that if Iraq grew broccoli, we wouldn't be there. So what was the reason given? We had to bring rule of law and democracy to Iraq. Rule of law and democracy. And there was Bremer. Interesting. I once talked about this subject at Yale and elsewhere, but at Yale, there was somebody in the audience that was one of the people who was writing the edicts for Bremer. You can all see these edicts, 100 of them. You can get them on your computer. About 1,000 pages. My librarian printed it out for me. And I said at one point, the Patriot Act was unpatriotic in my talk. And this man got absolutely livid. And he said, how can you say the Patriot Act is unpatriotic? Look at Cuba! I said, I'm not looking at Cuba, I'm looking at the United States. He turned out to be a Cuban-American lawyer sent to Iraq to write one of the 100 edicts, or several of the 100 edicts, for Bremer. Just a kid. Couldn't be over 30. And when I was at the World Bank and bumped into some lawyers that had written some of these edicts, I said to them, what did you think you were doing? And the guy, one of the guys looked at me and he said, my job. That's what they did in Auschwitz. My job. Someone told me to do it, so I did it. I mean, if you look at these edicts, you'll know what happened under colonialism everywhere, starting in 1492, when Columbus went to the West Indies and took a notary with him. It's called plunder. Listen to order number 39. Allows for the privatization of Iraq's 200 state-owned enterprises. 100% foreign ownership of Iraqi business. National treatment of foreign firms. Unrestricted tax-free remittance of all profits and other funds. 40-year ownership license. Order 40. Changes the banking sector from a state-run to a market-driven system, allowing foreign banks to purchase up to 50% of Iraqi banks. Order 17 grants foreign contractors full immunity from Iraq's laws, etc., etc. Outrageous. Where are the law schools? Where are the law professors? Where are the lawyers? Where are the ethics? Ugo Mate was my colleague. We had talked, and he had come and lectured to my class many times. He had written an article, which I read. I'd written an article, which he read. We're standing in the hall in Kroeber Hall, across from Bolt. I said, Ugo, you should turn that into a book. He stood there. He said, why don't we do it together? And I said, only if you be the lead author. It's interesting. I could not have written it. He could not have written it. I'm a Roman. He's in law and economics. I know something about the history. And we both knew a lot about the dark side of the rule of law and the uses of law for illegal purposes. Rule of law is different from rule of law ideology. All of us would agree we want rule of law, perhaps. But rule of law ideology is what the headlines were all about after the weapons of mass destruction were not found in Iraq. Plunder. When the rule of law is illegal. Rule of law rhetoric. It's always wrapped up in movements. First, the civilizing process. How many of you have heard of Locke and Emmerich de Vattel? Interesting. One wrote in 1698. The other wrote in 1797, both which gave legal justification for the colonial appropriation of North and Central and South American lands. It was plunder. They stole the lands. That's how we got our agricultural lands. The Dawes Act took the land from Native Americans. This is the way in the Law of Nations it was put. The earth belongs to all mankind. All men have a natural right to inhabit it. All men have an equal right to things which have not yet come into the possession of anyone. When, therefore, a nation finds a country uninhabited and without an owner, it may lawfully take possession of it. In connection with the discovery of the New World, it is asked whether a nation may lawfully occupy any part of a vast territory in which are to be found only wandering tribes whose small number cannot populate the whole country. We are not departing from the intentions of nature when we restrict savages within narrower bounds. justifying the take, 1797. Now what's interesting is, it's not just 1797. It's been continuous for 500 years. It's still going on in this country. Taking native lands, taking native water, justifying it through the civilizing process. Now in this book of ours, we understand that we're all complicit. So we devote a special chapter to how economists, lawyers, and anthropologists are complicit. In anthropology, we found a very highly respected theoretician, Julian Stuart, who was giving reasons why it was that the government could to take the Western Shoshone, the Paiute lands, for its own. And that happened under George Bush, that they finally concluded that claim. The Paiute, a Great Basin Shoshone band, the land in question dealt with millions of acres of land acquired by the U.S. government without compensation or treaty agreement. The strategy of the government was to deny title to the Indian plaintiffs on the grounds that they were not organized societies. And it was Julian Stuart's categorization of what an organized society is that had the right to own land that was behind the take. Now what's interesting is this was brought to my attention by a Canadian anthropologist. Handed me an article when I was up in Vancouver giving a talk. You might be interested in this, he said. He had found, looking at the archives, where was Julian Stuart working when he wrote this special justification? In the Justice Department. The U.S. Justice Department. So all of us have complicit relations on these issues. Another reason for, given for using law for illegal purposes is modernization. You go around the world and you tell people you lack this and you lack that, including lacking schools, which is not the same as education, by the way. People have been educated long before we had schools. And in fact, what's going on now, 2 years ago I went back to Zapotec country to do a film. It's called Losing Knowledge. Losing knowledge? How did that happen? They were autonomous. They knew how to weave their own clothes when I went there. They grew their own food. They had their own soft drinks. They had land that was the commons for people who wanted to use it to grow food who didn't have land. They were autonomous. They had to be. There were no roads. They couldn't get goods in, so they produced them. Now they know how to do that. What's the reason? NAFTA. NAFTA and the road. Roads are disastrous for indigenous people. What did NAFTA do? NAFTA was a trade agreement, undoubtedly written by lawyers. Passed the Congress. Nobody read it. It was too big. In fact, Nader gave a prize to somebody who would read it in the Congress. One Republican from the Southwest did, and he changed his mind. The Mexicans didn't read it either. They just signed it, according to Cuauhtemoc Cardenas. I asked them if they had. He said, no, we didn't know what we were signing. So what happened up there in Zapotec country? They bring in Midwestern corn. Mind you, this is the place where corn was invented. There are 25 or 26 different kinds of corn. And they bring in corn that's good for pigs to Zapotec country. They undersell the Indians. The lands are now lying fallow. And guess where the Indians are? Los Angeles. They come north. Oh, it's all legal. But no ethics. 5 centuries we covered of this kind of justification, civilizing mission, the modernizing mission, then the development mission. These are all shams for the most part. They're teaching Zapotec women how to use computers. Why do they need to learn how to use computers for anyway? Why should everybody learn to use computers? Actually, what's the interesting thing about this was every house, every little adobe house I went into had a computer. It did have a function. It was very important. When the Canadian mining engineers went up into that area to ask permission to mine for gold and silver, because it's full of gold and silver still, the Indians came together and they said, no, we know what you guys do around the world. We see it on a computer. We can connect. They have all kinds of networks now. Biopiracy. Right? So they're using these networks for purposes of self-protection. The latest rhetoric for rule of law is democracy. My father used to say the best way to sell democracy is to be one. The Patriot Act is unpatriotic. Where are the law professors? Somebody besides Professor Cole? Somebody beside the Guild? Somebody beside, where is Harvard? Dershowitz, Berkeley, you, totally getting away with literally murder. There should be up in arms. It's something that needs to be explained. If you had ethics courses in the curriculum that were about social responsibility and something more than the dyadic relationship, maybe. That's what critical studies was supposed to do. What happened to critical studies from Harvard and so forth? It got esoteric. It got abstract. It lost the sense of injustice that Kahn was talking about. Now, one of the things that's happening, one of the things I'm dedicating myself to more and more, is the object of reducing hubris everywhere. It's the only thing that's going to save us. We're so arrogant. And I'm just not talking about the West. The West happens to still have a lot of power. The West is on its way out. But it could be just as bad if China was on its way in. They have hubris. So I started this seminar, and I'm doing a book collection called What the Rest Think of the West. Japan, China, India, Islam. We've got schools in this country, but Americans are so ethnocentric, it's beyond belief. Ignorance beyond belief for a multicultural nation. They have no idea that Afghanistan is the most incredible example of decentralized law, successful decentralized law in terms of survival of any country in the world. They don't know anything about Afghanistan. Nobody conquers Afghanistan. They don't know anything about Iraq. And they won't know anything about Iraq when they leave. They won't even remember that we were part and parcel of killing over 1 million people in Iraq. Why do they hate us? Where's the rule of law? Where's the rhetoric? Where's the action? We came to end this book. We realized that 500 years of these examples that are not just about other countries. They're about our own. 2000, that was a coup. Electoral plunder. Where were the lawyers? It was a coup. My European friends said it was a coup. The Latin American friends said a coup. A few Americans whispered. He got away with it. And Gore led him. Although Gore won. Electoral plunder. transforming the war on terror to the war on the Bill of Rights. Very few people report on that. Amy Goodman, Democracy Now! She's the one that has all the lawyers that are working on that. Never hear it on the mainline press, hardly at all. The Bush Declaration on the judicial model being dead. When I've gone to other countries, people always ask me about the tort law, especially if I'm speaking to lawyers. They've heard about American tort laws. It's the greatest tort law in the world. And we've been destroying it. The things that we have, the vision that we've given the world, whether we've achieved it or not is another question. We've been destroying it. In our book, we talk about what happened in Argentina, the neoliberal plunder, the use of rule of law, structural adjustment programs to create debts and obligations, call options, derivatives, other kinds of speculation designed to benefit foreign elites rather than the developing nations. Of course, lawyers are involved in that kind of work, but they're just dealing with their client who asked them to write it up, set it up. In the conclusion, we realize that we don't want a world without law. Legitimacy is at stake here. Legitimacy. If people think that you can get away with it, then that's the Reagan ethic. The Reagan ethic is, if nobody calls you on it, do it. If you can get away with it, do it. And they've been doing it. And they've been getting away with it. So the question is, are we a country of law? Are we a model for other people? Interestingly enough, and I'll just say this to wind up, is that in a way we still are a model. But what is it that we are a model of? In the last chapter, we went around looking at special cases. What was going on in India? Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola is the most corrupt company. Every time I see one of their trucks in Berkeley, Berkeley has given them a monopoly on the campus. Shocking. Destroying the underwater, the water, drinking water, farming water. But the way they won was by the use of law, according to the British. They quoted the British law. Our legal system, based on English common law, includes the public trust doctrine as part of its jurisprudence. The state is the trustee of all natural resources, the public at large the beneficiary. So although there is no law specifically regulating the extraction of groundwater, the panchayat and the state are required to prevent any over-exploitation of the underground reserves. The court gave Coca-Cola a month to cease water extraction, ordered the panchayat and the state to ensure the demand was met. The struggle over Coca-Cola then spread to other areas. So you could say we've had. China, there was an interesting case. In China, there are people up in arms all the time over what rapid industrialization has done to the water, the lands, pollution, terrible. A doctor in charge of being a doctor trained under the communist regime finds that people are dying, the waters are polluted. So he happens to have seen an American movie, Aaron Brockovich. And he takes that as his model. And he goes to Beijing and he says, I want some justice, just like the Americans got justice. He got attention. That's a model that you can say comes from art. But then there's another view. There's a law professor in Tanzania named Risa Shivji, jurisprudential scholar. He wrote a piece. He was supposed to go to England to a conference on law, just as the U.S. started to invade Iraq. Because the British were with us, he decided to boycott. But he wrote a piece called Law's Empire and the Empire of Lawlessness, Beyond Anglo-American Law. And in that, he said, we have to rethink the Enlightenment. We have to rethink Anglo-American law. We have to develop a law for this planet that comes from using the best of all the civilizations. It was actually a very generous statement, because he must have been very angry. Interestingly, this business of the place of Western law that's being challenged today, worldwide, and we should know that. We should not be like Cardozo says, no matter how objective. We must always remember we see with our own eyes. And it's interesting that one of the reviews of this book, its first sentence, starts this way. Some scholars, and I am one of them, will hold that the supremacy of the West is coming to an end. And anybody who knows anything about empires knows that they rise and fall. And the whole notion that we think that the future is going to be an extrapolation of what we've got today is foolish. That's what got us into this depression we're in. So I think Shivji is right. We have to be more humble. We have to look around the world and see what solutions we have. And we have to begin to formulate, as some people have already begun, a way to get together as a planet, not only to save the resources, but to save ourselves. And I think that regardless of what anybody could say about the dark side of law, the only hope is the light side of law that we've also talked about. Thank you very much.
Would you comment on the bailout plan that's going on, transferring wealth quickly, and what we might be able to do to get our new administration to stop it?
Everything. The answer to the last question, what you might do, everything and anything. Gore Vidal said it some time ago. This is a country where you have socialism for the rich and capitalism for the poor. The bailout is, I'm no specialist in this, so I know that Ugo has a lot to say on the subject, but it's very clear that it's just a deal. There are no strings attached. It's just bailout. And there's going to be more bailout and more bailout. This is going to be, the person to watch on this is Stiglitz and Krugman. They should really be, I don't know why he doesn't have them in Washington, except maybe he wanted continuity with the Clinton era. Which is what got us into this also. I mean, Clinton was no saint on the economics end of it. So it's sort of like the quote FDR when he said, make me do it. I think those of you who are activists have to get in there and make them do it. Get the right advice.
Under the other thought of resources, would you talk about water and specifically what's happening with the transfer of water as a commodity in law?
I'm not a lawyer. I'm an anthropologist, but I do know that there's a water problem. And I do know, as you probably know, what the Bolivians did about it when Bechtel went in and privatized the water. I don't believe that things like water should be privatized anywhere in the world. The things that we have to, I just can't even comprehend how that could begin to happen. There's resistance. There was resistance in California as well. And we always should resist any of that kind of privatization. It's not privatization. As my brother keeps correcting me, it's corporatization.
On that same issue, I've seen it proposed that there be an amendment to the United Nations Charter of Human Rights that guarantees a right to water. Do you think that's something that we could pursue, and how best might we go about that?
Anything that makes the corporatization of water not possible, we should try and do. There are places in the world. I mean, I can just see the scene for Zapotec country, because it's very rich in water. And the valley of Oaxaca is not rich in water. And I can just see what's going to happen, because as I said to my Zapotec friends, 500 years they didn't conquer you, but they conquered you in the last 40. Because they're going to try and bring the water down. They're going to go up there, they're going to see the land is, in quotes, empty because they're not using it. They're, underselling the corn and so on and so forth. And then they're going to say, okay, you guys, the state is now in there. The state was not in there. There were autonomous villages. This has all happened in 40, 50 years. Very fast. And it's happening worldwide. I just happen to see this little slice. These are basic things. Something the initial speaker said it very well this morning. We have to get our mind off of the immediate and look at these long term. If I weren't an anthropologist, I'd be a historian. There's no insight that comes. If I show the day after Trinity, I was saying about the bomb, the making of the bomb, to my class, and they never heard of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. These are Berkeley students. It's just, blanked out. There are all these things that are totally blanked out. Just like nobody knows who Abraham Lincoln and Washington, because we don't celebrate their birthday by their name anymore. We just have President's birthday. So history is very important to having people understand. And there's a very interesting book called Worked Over, Corporate Destruction of an American Community, written by an anthropologist named Dukas, Cornell University Press. And she does 100 years of what happened in northern New York State, from the mill towns that were run by regional capitalists. Very interesting. And then the big trusts came in, got rid of the regional capitalism, then it was sort of capitalism at a distance, the place was run down, and so on and so forth. So it's an amazing story. The only story I've ever read that really explains the difference between regional capitalism, corporate capitalism, which didn't happen without lawyers, and the result. I often say when I'm abroad and people complain about the United States, this and that, I said, the one thing you should remember is the government is different than the people, because they've done everything to the American people almost that they've done elsewhere. There were more atom bombs that were tested in the United States than anywhere in the world. And if you want to see the consequence of that debacle, you should look at the nuclear legacies all up and down the West Coast, from Hanover all the way down to Southwest. Read the book, The Tainted Desert. Yeah, it's astonishing. So there's something about self-preservation that we're losing or we've lost. Just self-preservation. Some sense of survival, of, organ survival, if nothing else. We're buying and selling body parts worldwide. Companies are doing that too. We're all complicit in this, because that's what schools should do. This self-esteem stuff, I'm not much one on, I have to say, Meg. It was invented as a controlling process. So I'll tell you an example. A woman from Lebanon who brought her children to the United States because she didn't want them to be killed by Israeli bombs was at a dinner party, and she said to me, Laura, her kids were at school now. She said, what is this thing called self-esteem? We don't have that problem in Lebanon. 10 years later, they had the problem. It came in with cosmetic surgery. So it's now in China. They've got problems with self-esteem in China. I mean, come on. So these are controlling processes that get managed through, it was invented in California, self-esteem.
What do you think of the concept of citizen's arrest?
Well, it's a great concept. It should be more often used. They did try to arrest, wasn't it Cheney that tried Monbiot in England tried to arrest Cheney?
I was listening to Robert Fisk recently talking about his opinion after having been in Afghanistan for so long of, you know, why we should basically give up and leave it alone because they're not us and we're not them and, you know, it's a completely different system. And yet the justification that you hear for that sort of thing over and over again is, as you stated, we need to bring them democracy and the rule of law. How do you combat that argument sort of with more of what he's saying is they're not us and we're not them and we need to just...
It's not our business. It's just imperialism. And besides, go back to what my father said. Let's be one. And then the world will want to, if it really works, they might want to be like that too. But it doesn't work for everybody anyway.
Right, but no one seems convinced of that. I mean, if you went around the general public
here...
Well,
one's missionaries. I mean, it's really, you know what this comes from? European, Euro-American exceptionalism. We really think we're special. And we have a special something to give the world. You know, Woodrow Wilson addressed in 19 whatever, as president, he addressed the salesman's meeting of, the national meeting of salesmen. And he said, go thou forth and sell your goods. And along with your goods will be American concepts of freedom and democracy. I mean, come on. And we did it to Europe first. The whole notion of consumerism a la American style and so on and so on.
Right, well, Andrew Bacevich's book on that is
but it's not just Americans that feel exceptional, by the way. That's the important thing to see. It's not just Euro-Americans. I'll tell you, if the Chinese take over the world, they will be the exceptionalists as well. It comes with empire. But the thing that we're trying to say in the Plunder book is that what we did was, we weren't smarter than anybody. We just knew how to plunder better. We took over a whole new world, right? And then we said, we're smarter than you are. And you lacked this and you lacked that. The lack, we talk about the theory of lack in this. Everybody lacks and we have what they lack. We can give you computers. We can give you, you know, whatever you lack, we can give you. Well, what if they turned that around and said, you know, we think you lack. You lack human rights. You lack democracy. Yeah.
Thank you for coming. I just had a question about, follow on. Why do you think that the American government acts as the world police in terms of, and then I wanted to hear a little bit about your perspective on the Middle East in general and why do we think, I mean, not that I support the way that they do things either, but why do you think our foreign policies go the way that they are?
Well, in a word, it has to do with empire and imperialism. So, our Middle East policy has been really screwed up by the whole Israeli issue and the backing in Israel. Einstein warned us of this. Einstein supported a homeland for Jews, but he didn't support a state because he knew where it was going to go. And there's a very interesting letter that Einstein and Hannah Arendt published in the New York Times along with several other distinguished Jewish scholars. 1948, it's really an amazing letter because what they said there basically has come to pass. Now, Anthony Nutting, who was foreign minister of England, I think, during the 67 war, he said something very interesting. It's stuck in my head ever since. He said, Israel is a Western beachhead in the Middle East. And that promoted, made me think that really the people who support the powers that be, the military that supports all of the stuff that's going on in Israel and allows Israel to go into South Lebanon, to Gaza, and so on and so forth. They don't really care about Jews. It's a Western beachhead in the Middle East. If there were no oil in the Middle East, I bet nobody would care about that part of the world, especially. unless they cared about water, they might care. I mean, resources. There are going to be resource wars. There are resource wars. So the whole, I mean, Falk is the person you should look at on this material. He's very good. International lawyer, for instance.
Laura, thank you very much for your presentation about plunder and tying it in with empire. I just wanted to tie both plunder and empire in with commons.
Thank you.
And to do it by mentioning Mountstuart Elphinstone, a British, Scottish diplomat and imperialist who left Peshawar for an embassy to Kabul in 1811. In his kit, he had a copy of Tacitus. Tacitus, whose German Wars was his reading as he tried to understand how did the barbarians of the north divide their lands, which were held in common. Mountstuart Elphinstone, in arriving in Afghanistan, saw in Afghan land tenure relations forms of rotation of land, of sharing of water, called the Wesh, which he related directly to the commons that Tacitus had described. And so I put it to us that the war in Afghanistan on behalf of United States imperial interests is a war for the destruction of the commons. And if we think any other way, we are deceiving ourselves. Anyway, I wish to... I just
thank you for saying that. I'll just add one thing. The French went into Tunisia. They destroyed the commons of the oasis that had a distribution, a water distribution system going. And then when Tunisia became independent, they continued the French destruction of the oasis, and now there's no oasis economy at all. Yeah.
Yeah, I just wondered to what extent you think it's a failure on the part of lawyers or advocates in general to characterize the uses of land, of property, of resources that are different than those of the dominant culture, that it's our failure as advocates that is causing problems in that regard.
Well, there's nothing more Eurocentric than the law, is there? So most lawyers don't know anything about law in other societies. But most people in other societies know a lot about our law. So it's kind of a lopsided understanding. And I think it would really help. Comparative law is taught usually a common law, civil law. One day on Islamic law and one day on Chinese law. But very little. So Ugo Mate at the Comparative Law Conference this year turned it around, and he made the theme "What the Rest Think of the West." And he had China law, Afghani, speaking of Afghan law, and Indian, Islam, etc. And the result of that was an audience that was just dead silence. It was so foreign to be hearing at a Comparative Law Conference. It wasn't that they were not appreciative. It was just like, you know, from Mars. And I think we need to know more about the world since we are in the world and have our military bases all over it. So, yes, thank you.